this girl wrote me, I'm not that structured. I think, if I remember correctly, that's where we finished last time, just before. Is that correct? Wow. I think you're very, a great skeptic of that. Always agree with me, which is people I like. All your memory is good. Okay, so we're all ready to the top. We go. You okay there? Did they sound good? Okay, so here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So in these Sutta classes, which when I have the opportunity to lead them, you will see that this document called Word of the Buddha is based on a very old translation done by a Venerable Yama Chinonka, almost 100 years ago by now. And so I decided to retranslate it, but still keep the same form. Taking sutras, sayings of the Buddha from different parts of the Sutta Pitaka and rearranging them into a form according to the form of the true Eightfold Path. And as I was doing this, I was making sure that the translations are improved. And it's not a, what's the word he used? It's not a paraphrase, it is a translation. Because I'm taking my cue from Professor A.K. Warder, for whose books on the Pali language inspired me and taught me my Pali, where he said the unit of language is a phrase or a sentence, not a word. And he was advising Professor of Sanskrit at Cambridge. And he was advising that if you do any translations, do not translate word by word, you translate phrase by phrase, or sentence by sentence. And that way you avoid a lot of problems. And just talking with Venerable this morning, there's one such problem which Buddhists, many Buddhists would know of, when the Satipatthana Sutta, where in each of the four Satipatthanas, they translate to contemplate the body in the body, feeling in feeling, mind in mind, dhammas in dhammas. And that is one of the problems when you translate word for word, because that is not what it means. It means just to contemplate the body, to contemplate the feeling. It is one of those idioms in foreign language. Sentence construction is not the same as the way we construct sentences in English. In Pali, they often have you do dishwashing of dishes, you do path sweeping of paths, you do car driving in a car, and of course, car driving except in a car. But that is just the way of the Pali language. It doesn't mean anything else, except you do drive a car. So this is the idiom here, and when you translate word for word, you put a lot of stuff in here which does not belong. So here, this translation is accurate, and it is done phrase by phrase, which makes it more readable and more powerful. So, I think the last time I got up to just before the Anatta doctrine, so now we come to some descriptions of the five components of existence. These are what makes up the human being. And just very quickly, it is the body, it is the experience, it is the perception, will, and consciousnesses. Not just one, but many. And then, after that, we have similes for them.
This is the Anatta doctrine from the Sanyutta Nikaya. Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam, and a person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and... Okay, good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, insubstantial. I am wondering whether I've got the right one here again. Can you just hold on for a moment, please? I'm sorry, but I might have got the wrong. Where's it gone again? We did this last time. Because some of these are not as well translated. Please excuse me a moment. Yeah, okay, it was the wrong one. I don't know what you have over here. What do you have for the Anatta doctrine? Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam, a person with good sight would inspect it. A person with good sight would inspect it. Okay. Good, excellent, yes. So I think I had the older form, which was much more bad English. Okay, great, I got the right one again. Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a mere lump of foam? Okay, I think that's what you've got. If you find out you've got something different, let me know. So all these ones, I'm continually upgrading them, improving them. So what substance could there be in a mere lump of foam? So too, whatever kind of form, body there is, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, insubstantial. What substance could there be in form, the stuff, things? And if any of you has done any physics, you know that all this stuff, it appears to be hard, but there's actually nothing really there. Just, first of all, molecules, and the molecules, atoms, there's neutrons and protons, and it's mostly 99.9999999% nothing, emptiness. It is very much like foam. Suppose it were raining and big raindrops are falling. A water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? Just this is the simile for experience. It's just a plop and it's gone. And some of you may know that the Scottish poet Robbie Burns, one of the verses in one of his famous poems was, pleasures are like poppies spread, you pluck the flower, the bloom is shed, or like the snowfall in a river, white for a moment, then gone forever. Just this quickness, the fastness of any experience, it's a plop in the river, and then it's gone, no substance. So too, whatever kind of experience there is, past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate, experience, to be void, empty, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in experience? Suppose that in the last month of the hot season around noon, a shimmering mirage appears. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. for what substance could there be in a mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in perception? Ah, okay. It may be the other one. Okay, let's go to the other one. Won't tell you to take a second. Okay. Delusion. So what else? We're passing from what's in it. With them, avoid hollowness of voxel. Void, hollow, and insubstantial. What have you got? I've got void, insubstantial. It is the same. Okay, it's just not moving. Okay. So anyway, they give the simile of perception being like a mirage. So it appears to be one thing, but you give it a meaning it doesn't deserve. So every time you perceive someone, you don't like them. It's just a mirage. What aren't you not liking in them? You see someone and you do like them. What are you liking in them? It's just a mirage of perception. You cannot trust perceptions because whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. If you inspect and carefully investigate it, it would appear to you to be void, empty, insubstantial. What substance could there be in perception? It's just like a mirage. Suppose a person needing hard wood would take a chainsaw and enter a forest. You see, they don't use traditional Pali. But anyone who's going to get some wood in a forest these days would not take a two-handed saw like it says in the original sutta. They would take a chainsaw. So this is what I mean. You translate phrases, not words. Suppose the person eating hardwood would take a chainsaw and enter a forest. There they would see the trunk of a large banana tree, straight, fresh, without fruit but core. They would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, unroll the coil. As they unrolled the coal, they would not find even soft wood, let alone hard wood. A person with good sight would inspect and carefully investigate it, and would appear to them to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in the trunk of a banana tree? So too, whatever kind of will there is, whether past, future, or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect it and carefully investigate it. And as you investigate them, it appears to you to be void, empty, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in volition, in will? We always think right in the center of will is the hard wood of me. I am at the center of my will. But when you actually unroll it, you find there's nothing in the center. It's insubstantial, no hardwood at all in your will. Suppose that a magician, David Copperfield, would perform a trick at a crossroads. A person with good eyesight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to them to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a magical illusion? So too, whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, you inspect and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to you to be void, empty and substantial. For what substance could there be in consciousness? says. So, giving the simile like a magician's trick, appearing as one thing, but you're not really seeing that it's just a flow, substantial, void, empty, with no core in it. Any comments? With David Copperfield. It's David Copperfield was dead. I thought he's still alive, isn't he?
I don't know.
I don't.
And I just thought that was rather interesting because it was like a trick because he's a magician.
He is, yeah.
So
anyway,
get the connection between
what you were saying, which is weird stuff, that after your daughter died. She came to you in a dream or in waking time?
No, I was awake.
Awake?
I was sort of just starting to go off to sleep.
Starting to go to sleep, and it came to you. Well, we're not quite sure exactly what that is, but a lot of times if it's in that state, even if you are fully alert, fully awake, we see here about the way perception is. The perceptions are real, but we give them meaning they don't deserve. A mirage appears to be water on the road when it's very hot. We're actually seeing that, it's real, but we're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. So when we say about perception, often we see something and then we say, that's this person, that's that person. If it's someone who's like a David Copperfield who hasn't died...
Yes, the name actually came to me.
But that is where the perception just tricks you. It's probably somebody else. And that's what's happened to me a lot. You've seen somebody, and then straight away you say, that's Jacob. And then you touch them and it's not Jacob. They've just got some similarities. And your mind makes a connection which is not really deserving. It looks like Jacob Medding, but then you go and touch them and say, how do you know? I was mistaken, it's not you. That happens often. And that's just showing you how perception works on incomplete information and just makes one too many assumptions, which actually gives you what is actually impossible. And it's also one of the reasons why that after a person does die, I was always really intrigued why it is when people do die and they say that they go through the light, they meet people on the other side. And who do they meet? And I've talked to Christians, and they are absolutely certain, and they're not lying, that they saw Jesus, and that confirms their Christianity. And then there's other people, Catholics, and they swear to me that they saw Virgin Mary. There is people who are like Vietnamese Buddhists, and they're absolutely certain they saw Kuan Yin, the Goddess of Mercy. And there are some people who are atheists, they don't believe in any religion. And they say, no, honestly, I saw it, it was real, it was Uncle George, who passed away 2 years ago. And sometimes that made me wonder, what's going on there? Because these were real, they weren't lying, they weren't being deceived. These were real, honest people. And it's obvious after a while that it's not as if, as I wrote in one of my books, that there's like a... like a little office when you die and people actually look out who's dying. Here's John Treasure, so these are Buddhists, so this is your turn, Sariputta or something, to welcome John Treasure. This is a Christian, so Jesus, come on, your turn. It cannot be anything like that. Instead, all it is what you're actually seeing when you die. It's this beauty, this truth, this nimitta, and you add onto that what you expect. And the way that perception works, we add on a lot to what we see, what we hear. What we add on is what we expect. So if somebody says a nice thing to you, and if you hate that person, you don't expect a nice thing, We always interpret it, we perceive it. What do they mean by that? They're playing some game, aren't they? These are just examples of how perception adds on to reality, and that's what's presented to our conscious awareness. So that's why perception is insubstantial. You cannot trust it. It's a mirage. Anyway, but the trick of the crossroads, the idea of a magician, and apparently magicians have told me that, you know, what they do, they try and take your attention away from the truth. So they, it's like, it's not so deceiving you, it's grabbing hold of your perception and pushing it to another place, where the real trick is not happening. So it's a way of deceiving you, and that's a very good simile to what consciousness is. We're actually not looking at where the real action is happening, and instead we're looking at just at another part of the conscious process, especially usually the happiness and the unhappiness of it, instead of what actually is the consciousness, what's actually going on there. And if we could only see it, we'd actually see. Remember, there's one of our monks. I saw him recently when I was in England, Ajahn Vimalo. And he's a very, very wonderful monk, very, very funny. But he'd also, as a young man, he would do some magic tricks. And he would perform some magic tricks for us, for the monks. Were you there, Buddha, when he came? No. But just a very simple magic trick of taking a piece of tissue paper in his hand and moving it backwards and forwards, and then it just totally vanished. And right in front of you, you know, it was really amazing. He made a piece of tissue paper vanish. But actually, when you were standing to the side, you know, when, you know, he wasn't actually putting your attention in a place it shouldn't be, you saw him, he just actually threw it past a person. But the person never saw that. He was deceived to look somewhere else when he actually threw the piece of tissue paper past. And he said, this is what magic is. You know, you let people focus on a place where the action isn't really happening. And where they're focusing on one place, you can do all sorts of stuff on the other place. And that's actually how you deceive people, just like consciousness. Anyway, for what substance could there be in consciousness? So these are the Buddha's similes of the five khandhas, the components of existence. The body is just like foam, there's nothing solid in it. That even experience is just so momentary, just like a raindrop plop and it's just gone. And that perception is a mirage, cannot trust it. And that will, the fourth of the khandhas, the fourth component of existence, is a like a banana tree. Or Bhante Ji, Venugunaratana, he adapted that simile and adapted it very, very well. And he said, instead of looking at a banana tree, he said, let's call it an onion. Because an onion has got nothing solid. You can peel it, and in the center it's got nothing solid there. It's just a lot of leaves are wrapped around one another with nothing in the center. But also, he said, the word onion is good, because when you do peel it, you do investigate, will always makes you cry, and that peeling an onion. And also, he said, the word itself, onion, it goes on and on with an I in the middle, which I thought was really cool. Yes? Yeah.
Ajahn Brahm, don't you think those similes, it seems very harsh, you know, for a lay person?
Ah, yes. This is why it's called a sutta class for the advanced. Any namby-pamby cream puffs, you better get out now because it's going to get more tough.
I was thinking, say a newcomer, you know, you see this, oh.
Exactly.
Maybe what I do is you can slowly cut down on things. Those who see even perception, you know,
yeah,
an object that's suffering, you know.
That's why we have the Friday night talk. We have a few jokes, funny stories.
for a newcomer or
exactly.
They
so this
slowly
is
slowly cut it down. Some
this,
ask them not to do this, they go cuckoo.
This is not for newcomers, this class.
Okay.
That's actually why we started this class a long time ago. Because people said, oh, the Friday night talks, it's very nice and very wonderful. We go back sort of inspired and we have wonderful advice on how to live our lives with not much problem. We can overcome many emotional problems. But what about something a bit deeper? So that's why we started the Sutta class for.
Okay,
so, yeah.
Yeah,
so this is, but you're advanced. How long have you been coming to this place?
No, I was just thinking of the newcomers.
Yeah, okay.
Fair enough, we said we are all advanced, fair enough.
Yeah, fair enough, good, okay.
Thanks.
Okay, and now we carry on with the five components of existence. One who seeks satisfaction in the body seeks only suffering. One who seeks suffering, I say, is not freed from suffering. One who seeks satisfaction in experience seeks only suffering. One who seeks satisfaction in perception seeks only suffering. One who seeks satisfaction in volition, otherwise known as will, seeks only suffering. One who seeks satisfaction in consciousness seeks only suffering. And one who seeks suffering is not freed from suffering. So what does that actually mean by that? Seeking suffering, seeking satisfaction in the body, it's when you're a young man or a young woman and you're pretty, you're strong, you're healthy, and you know you get sort of quite attached to your health and also to your physical appearance. Sometimes people have to go through hell to keep looking beautiful. You know, I saw a picture of, I look at the news on my little tablet here, of Nicole Kidman as some more awards or something going on, some Oscars or something. And you can see close up just, you know, how a once beautiful face needs a lot of makeup to keep looking as she's expected to look.
And Botox.
Botox as well, nose jobs, boob lifts, I don't know what else. But whatever it is, it's a lot of suffering to keep up a personal image. And the same with guys, you know, trying to keep that up. I remember even seeing like the great Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali. I met him once. I got his photograph, his autograph when I was 11, when he was in London. Really nice guy. But you know, after a while, you know that he was the great boxer, the Cassius Clay, and people would actually come up to him and just when he was in his 60s or something, you know, he couldn't do that anymore. But if you find satisfaction in your physical prowess, it's a lot of suffering when it starts to disappear. So you only seek satisfaction in suffering. Or seek satisfaction in experiences. How many more experiences do you want in your life? Because sometimes people always want another experience. And it seems to be the experiences are also always to be more intense. What is it? There's that Japanese fish, a blowfish, and even with the best cooks, sometimes they make a mistake, just one tiny mistake, and it's going to kill you. And they go to these restaurants knowing that there's, you know, a reasonably good chance they won't come out of that restaurant alive. But they do that knowing, you know, that blowfish might kill them. No, because the experience, the danger, is something which they get addicted to. All the other experiences, they've been there, done that, and it doesn't really create any joy for them anymore. They get dull, satiated. So the next experience always has to be a little bit more intense every time. Which is why seeking satisfaction in experience is only seeking satisfaction in suffering. And in perceptions, trying to seek satisfactions in perceptions, suffering. And especially like seeking satisfaction in will is only in other words, getting a stronger will, fighting your will against other people's will. Where that ends up is being present in the United States and being a real pain in the ass. So why do people want to do that anyway? And seeking satisfaction in consciousnesses, to being aware, being alert, because much of what you're aware of is not really very pleasant. So consciousnesses is consciousness of a lot of suffering, which is why a lot of people don't like being conscious. They like to just distort their consciousness or dull it with drugs. So seeking satisfaction in those things is seeking satisfaction in suffering. Remember, this is all part of the First Noble Truth. So yes, it may look a bit negative, but the escape is coming next. So, why this laughter? Why this joy when it's ever blazing in a fire, shrouded all about in gloom? Won't you look for the light? Look at this well-groomed body, a mass of sores popped up full of illness, with nothing stable or lasting. This body is worn out, so fragile, a nesting ground for disease, this putrid body dissolves. And that reminds me of that story of Venerable Jnanaponika. For those of you who have a copy of things like the middle-length sayings, the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, as first translated by Venerable Jnanaponika, I had the good fortune of meeting him in Sri Lanka many years ago, a very lovely old monk. He obviously passed away now. And the reason why he became a monk was that he was a young man in pre-war Germany, just enjoying his life, and he was at a beer garden. The beer gardens was set around a house somewhere in the beautiful countryside of Germany, and they would make the beer there, they'd sell it, and they had all the places on the outside, the little benches and tables, where you go with your friends and have some beer and have a really good time. And they still have those beer gardens in Germany today, but maybe not as rustic as in his day. And he was with some friends, having a few beers, having a good laugh, a nice time with his mates. And then the house in which the beer was made and sold caught fire. There was a fire in the cellar. Oh no, it was actually higher up in the house, I think you remember telling me. And the owners of the beer garden house ran out. And a lot of his friends, young men and young women, ran into the house for free beer. And when they ran into the house for the free beer, the top story of the house collapsed and killed all of his friends. And of course, there's no emergency services in those days, pre-war Germany. And so he had to help with everybody else, douse the flames, pull off all of the burnt rafters and take away the charred remains of these young men and young women who were his contemporaries. And it affected him so much that he stopped whatever he was doing and went to Sri Lanka to ordain as a bhikkhu, as a monk. That was his defining experience in his life. Why this laughter, why this joy? When he read this, that really hit him so hard. Why this laughter, why this joy, when it is ever blazing? And then for him, the house was blazing. It was a real story. So anyway, this is one of the very hard, it's not for beginners, Eddie. You know, this is a problem. So, you know, we should do something about the problem. Don't go into the house to get some more free beer, because, oh, there's plenty of time. You don't know. And lastly, we have here, a bit more, the three warnings. And this actually you see very often in Buddhist stories of the Buddha. And this is actually one place where it comes. But my friend, didn't you ever see among human beings a man or a woman, 18, 90 or 100 years of age, frail, bent like a roof bracket? In those days, the houses did use actually bent pieces of wood as their ridge pieces. Bit crooked, wobbling as they go along, leaning on a stick, ailing, youth gone with broken teeth, with grey and scanty hair or bald, with wrinkled skin and blotched limbs, and forgetful. And of course, you know, you probably had mothers or fathers like that, grandparents like that. My friend, didn't it occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. Let me now do good karma by body, speech and mind while you can. So sometimes it kind of brings it home to us. But, my friend, didn't you ever see among human beings a man or woman sick, afflicted, gravely ill, bedridden, unable to look after themselves? My friend, didn't it occur to you, an intelligent and mature person, I too am subject to illness? I am not exempt from illness. Let me now do good karma by body, speech, and mind. And of course, we've all either had sicknesses ourselves, but we've recovered, thankfully. But you know, you see other people who don't recover with sickness. And in the end, sickness will, we recover, we'll escape it for a while, but it will come back to us. But my friend, didn't you ever see among human beings a man or woman in a coffin about to be cremated or buried? And again, if you look at the original there, it says a man and a woman being carried on a bier. And this is like the old times. This is actually just exactly what it means, but a much more appropriate translation. Did it not occur to you, an intelligent, mature person, I too am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. Let me now do good karma by body, speech, and mind. And in fact, just where you're sitting, John, there were two coffins the last week, one on Wednesday, one on Friday. So you're sitting in the place where the coffin usually lives. I thought I'd let you remember that. So, these are the three warnings. And what that really does is not just to make you negative and afraid, but to wake you up. So make sure you start doing your good karma, body, speech, and mind. And I don't mean getting more donations. I mean actually just keeping your precepts and learning how to meditate and just learning what's going on to free your mind. Now we have the messages about samsara. The word samsara literally means wandering on, like an endless journey. This samsara is without a beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings roaming and wandering on, blinkered by delusion and shackled to wanting. Now, of course, that's another new translation, which I thought has a bit more punch to it. First of all, the Buddha said specifically, samsara without a beginning. The whole idea of a creation, a beginning of a world, has never made any sense at all. Philosophically, logically, it never really was satisfying. In the same way that you know the answer I've given to that when people ask, well, how did this world begin? What do you mean it began? It's like saying a beginning to the planet Earth, an edge, a starting point. And that's exactly how people thought 300, 400, 500 years ago. They thought the Earth was flat. Go far enough in one direction, you fall off the beginning or the end, the edge. And now everybody knows the Earth is round. The Earth doesn't have edges, no beginnings, no ends. It goes round and round and round and round. And then you get to the whole space, the universe. If you go far enough, are you going to come to an end of this universe, an edge? Is there a beginning or an end of space, an edge? And you ask any astrophysicist and they'll say, no, there is not an edge. It is without any boundary space. Like planet Earth, it turns around on itself. It's curved space. So literally, if you go in any direction from here, any direction, eventually you'll come back to Dhammaloka Center. That's how important this place is. That bit is a bit of a joke, but it is absolutely true that there's no edge to the universe, no beginnings, no ends. The universe isn't flat. Earth is not flat, it's curved. Space is not flat, it's curved. It has no edges to it. And it doesn't take much to go to the next level and understand time is not flat. It doesn't have an edge to it. It doesn't have a beginning, not an end. No boundaries. the samsara is without beginning, without boundaries. Later on, 100, 200 years ago, or 200 years from now, people look back on this age and they would be so, amazed that people of the 21st century believed in flat time. Just like we look back on those who believed in a flat earth as being a little bit stupid, and they'll look back upon us who believed that time was flat, that it had beginnings and ends. How stupid could you be? Time, no beginning, no end. Our first point is not discerned, of beings roaming and wandering on. And this other thing, blinkered by delusion. You put blinkers on a horse when they go in a race to stop them being distracted by what's going on the left and the right. They're blinkered, they can't see the whole truth. That's what delusion does, it blinkers you. It blinds you to what's just on the other side of what you're being conditioned to see, and shackled to wanting, like we're addicted. Whether we want it or not, whether we need it or not, it's not the point. It's the very act of wanting gives us meaning in life, makes us who we are, which is one of the reasons why just to want for many people is to be alive. And not want anything is like to disappear, to vanish, which is one of the reasons why we have sales and the New Year's. Even if you don't need anything, you want something. And I will never forget that person who came to see me on one Friday. Does the temple need a TV set? LCD set? I said, no, we don't need one. He said, it's a new one. Well, you bought a new one. He said, yes, but why don't you use it yourself? Well, we don't need one in the house, he said. Well, why did you buy it then when you don't need it? And he said, because it was on sale. And I thought that was only women who did that. And that was a guy. You know, all the same, no gender stereotyping. He bought an expensive LCD TV screen, whatever it's called. Plasma, is it plasma TV? Whatever, you know what I'm talking about. It's huge TVs. He bought one. He didn't want it. He had a house full of TV sets. That's why I wanted to give it away. He only bought it for the one reason, it was on sale. And that's the addicted to wanting. So you're shackled to wanting. And the idea of not wanting anything, it just gets you into, you know, a place where you're not comfortable. So what do you think? Which is more, the stream of tears that you have wept as you roamed and wandered on through these many lives, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, this or the water in all the great oceans? Which is more, or the tears you've wept, or the waters in the oceans? The ocean. And the Buddha is saying, for a long time you've experienced the death of a father many millions of times. A brother, a sister, a son or a daughter, the loss of relatives, of wealth, the loss through illness, the loss of a girlfriend, a boyfriend, the loss of when your team hasn't won. I'm adding those things. As you have experienced this, weeping and wailing because of being united with the disagreeable and separated from the agreeable, the streams of tears that you have wept is more than the water in all the oceans. So says the Buddha. So that's a lot of lives, a lot of weeping. And of course, I often say that's why the water in the oceans are salty. That's only my joke. Or which do you think is more? The streams of blood, not just tears, blood, red stuff, that you have shed when you were beheaded just by one punishment. As you roamed and wandered on through this long course, this or the water in all the great oceans. For a long time you have been arrested as murderers. You're all murderers, according to the Buddha, sometime in your previous lives. Burglars and adulterers. When you were beheaded, the stream of blood that you shed is greater than the water in all the great oceans. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. A first point is not discerned of beings who blinker by delusion and shackle to wanting, are journeying through this round of rebirth and death. It makes like Groundhog Day look just like a picnic. For such a long time you've experienced suffering, agony and disaster, and swell the cemeteries with your bones from your many lives. You know all of the, the limestone? The limestone's all compressed dead bodies of shellfish. So I was told when I was young, I think it's still the same, isn't it? And you see these incredible limestone cliffs that go on and on, so deep, so huge. And how many shellfish have gone into that? Millions and billions of shellfish lives. So I often think of that when I read this simile. For such a long time you have swelled... Oh, here we go. I missed one, yeah, I thought so. Even just one person wandering on through their many lives, just one person, blinkered by delusion and shackled by wanting, would leave behind a stack of bones, a heap of bones, a mass of bones, as large as Mount Everest. Actually, they mention another mountain, I think Mount Sinira or something, which changed to Mount Everest, which people do know about. Would leave behind a stack of bones, a heap of bones, a mass of bones as large as Mount Everest if there was someone to collect them all, and what was collected would not perish. For what reason? Because this samsara is without a beginning. For such a long time you've experienced suffering, agony and disaster, and swell the cemeteries with your bones from your many lives. It is enough to experience revulsion towards all volitional formations. All will. Enough to let them go, enough to be liberated from them and not get reborn again. So that is the problem, how the Buddha described suffering. And now, the cause of suffering. Any questions before I go on? Yes, John. You've got to get the
When life transfers from the plant, the algae, to an animal, where does the consciousness come from? How does that begin?
This is where the only one place in the suttas where the Buddha says that even plant life has a rudimentary form of consciousness, a very rudimentary form of consciousness, in which the consciousness can actually evolve. So in other words, remember that these plants or animals or beings, these are only the vehicles where consciousness can find a footing, can develop and grow. So there's a parallel evolution going on. The evolution of the forms in which consciousness can exist in, and a separate evolution of consciousness itself. Streams of consciousness, okay, not a soul. But the stream of consciousness, a process of John Treasure. So now you have gone in this quite highly evolved body, you know, in which you are looking at me now, but eventually when you die, your stream of consciousness will go to another body. With the stream of consciousness, sometimes it can choose all sorts of highly evolved or less evolved bodies, depending upon its karma. So you've got a parallel development of form and also the stream of consciousness itself. So when you talk about plants, yeah, there must be a pretty rudimentary type of consciousness would actually go into a rudimentary type of vehicle in which it expresses itself.
So if we go back further, where does the consciousness begin with the first plant?
And then it says it before this physical universe began. And most of it was in what we call the mind-made realms. those are usually, you know, what they call like the jhana realms, which is not just a high state, but like a default state, when there's no physical stuff for the stream of consciousness to go into and to make use of. There's no sort of physical stuff there. Just quite automatically, the craving for that physical stuff, it cannot exist. So you do eventually, basically, go to the default state of the jhanas. Those jhana realms are totally, you know, in the realm of the mind, like I said on Friday, doesn't live, you know, in this human world. When this human world, you know, eventually vanishes, it goes through its cycles of existence and non-existence, or of the physical, but there's no beginning of the passage of consciousness or streams of consciousness. That is no beginning to your wandering. And even, yes, I mean, there is such a thing as a Big Bang, but as even Stephen Hawking keeps on saying nowadays, there was before the Big Bang. And there's always just, you know, this universe, if it can happen once, it can happen many times. So it's just world cycles of existence. And just in those cycles of existence, a new Big Bang creates a new universe as we know it. And but it's before the Big Bang, there was before as well. But then afterwards, that gives rise to forms which can evolve, and then the streams of consciousness can actually descend into those forms and take a life. And there's a beautiful periods, what they say in Buddhism, like, you know, this human realm, not too much suffering, not too much happiness, somewhere in between. Enough happiness, enough comfort that we can have the time and the purpose to develop ourselves and to find out the meaning of life. Because if there's too much suffering, we'd just be surviving. And survival will take up all of our time and energy rather than figuring out what the heck are we here for. Too much joy, too much happiness will just make us too indulgent. There's no incentive to do anything to find out about why we're here and who we are. So that's what they say, this world, the human realm, is a pretty neat, cool realm to be as a vehicle for us. There's enough of incentive of pain and suffering and disappointment, but there's a lot of free time and comfort for us to have the opportunity to come to places like this and listen to a Dhamma talk. So this is a pretty highly evolved state you're in right now. Does that make any sense? Okay. Okay, now we have the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the second noble truth, the why. Now this is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is the wanting which leads to rebirth, accompanied by enjoyment and desire. It's not the enjoyment and desire, it's the wanting. And enjoyment and desire comes with it. Seeking delight there. That is the wanting related to this five senses, the wanting to be, and even the wanting annihilation. Those are the three types of wanting. Now instead of calling it craving, which was the usual translation, craving was too intense. A wanting, and it omitted the most common form of the cause of suffering, which is this underlying, general, ordinary, everyday wanting something. So craving was a pretty good try at a translation for Dhamma, but it missed far too much. Wanting anything, even wanting good stuff, becomes a cause of suffering. And where does this wanting arise and become established? Wherever in the world there is anything agreeable and pleasurable, there this wanting arises and becomes established. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tangibles, mind objects in the world are agreeable and pleasurable, and there this wanting arises and becomes established. Wherever it's something agreeable and nice and you want it, doesn't have to be great pleasure, but sometimes if it's agreeable because you're at peace, you're comfort, you're asleep at night, wanting to go to sleep, is suffering. For those of you who've had insomnia, couldn't go to sleep last night. Just that wanting, and that wanting is what causes the sleeplessness. It causes the restlessness. It destroys contentment. There's one of my favorite sayings, which I even said last Friday, that when you want something more, you cannot enjoy what you have right now. Wanting destroys happiness. It promises you enjoyment, but actually it destroys contentment. The six consciousnesses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch and mind, are agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. Even wanting to hear, wanting to feel, even want that the consciousness experience itself, we want to be. This is where you find some people that when they're on their deathbed, they're so afraid that their consciousnesses will all disappear totally, they'll just vanish. They would rather be conscious and suffer than not to be conscious at all. And that's what they think is going to happen to them. And so that's one of the reasons why people linger on at their deathbed. They're afraid of losing all their consciousnesses, of losing their sense of being. They'd rather experience suffering and be conscious than not to be conscious at all. That's a wanting to be conscious, let alone wanting to be conscious of pleasure, wanting to be conscious itself.
Does their consciousness still survive?
Yeah, yeah, the consciousness carries on, yeah.
Yeah, so
but a lot of people think it doesn't. Yeah. And that they're terrified of that.
Mm. So then
it's much easier if you understand that your stream of consciousness continues on after death. People who've had the near-death experiences and they've come back again, they're not so afraid of death anymore. Why? It's because they know the consciousness continues on. It's not a sort of a blank stop, that's it, we disappeared.
But can't they be afraid of, yes, the consciousness is still going to carry on, but what is going to be created from that consciousness when they pass over?
Yeah, that is something different. But for most people, the fear is of non-existence.
Mm.
Consciousness gone, they'd rather be conscious than exist, even in pain. And not to be conscious at all. And that keeps so many people suffering at the very end.
I know. Ajahn Brahmit, sorry.
Yeah.
Is there any way of being able to possibly discover some of their consciousness of when they pass over, for them to be aware of that before they pass over?
Yeah, sure. It's called meditation.
Yeah, but my neighbour's 99 years old. She's not going to go into meditation now.
Why not?
Because she doesn't understand. She doesn't get it.
Good teaching. Just what I said the other day, things like just right now is the only time. What are you experiencing right now? Make that most important thing. Be kind. Okay. Sometimes people make meditation so damn difficult. Mm. Too complicated. Keep it simple. Why not? Anyway, it's leaving it a bit late in life, 99, I agree with that. So if you can find out beforehand, it makes life much easier. It doesn't make life more easy, it makes death more easy. We always want to make life easy, how about making death more easy? Experience of the six senses is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this wanting arises and becomes established. We always want to experience new experiences. Go to the Great Wall of China, go and see the, I don't know what you want to experience next. People have got these bucket lists of all the sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches of mind objects they want to do before they die. Absolutely crazy. Perception of sight sounds, just to perceive, is pleasurable. That is, wanting arises and becomes established. To interpret it, which is what perception is, to actually to work it out. Will in regard to sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable, and that is, wanting arises and becomes established. This is the will to control, the desire to control. We want to be. We're so afraid to let go. We want to will. The wanting of sight, sound, smells, taste, mind objects is agreeable. That's already. Oh, yes. Okay, just the, this is wanting to want. The wanting of sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. We like to plan things. We like to figure it all out. We like wanting. So this is a wanting to want. That's why, you know, if you're not doing anything, oh, let's get a problem, let's get a project, let's do something. If you're ever in any committee or any monastery, there's always something, new project. Because we like wanting stuff. We want to want. And thinking of sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. This is the most crazy part of human nature. We want to think. We actually, many of us like thinking. We actually spend a lot of time, maybe in the bed early in the morning. Oh, let's think of something. A nice juicy fantasy, or let's think about, you know, all the problems in the world and how we would solve them. Let's actually think of how we can assassinate Donald Trump before he becomes inaugurated. Let's... Why do people do that? Because they like to think. I forget what the original translation was, but what it really means, it's fantasizing about sight, sound, smells, taste, touches, and mind objects is agreeable and pleasurable, and there this wanting arises and becomes established. Do we like to fantasize? Even though we know it's a total waste of time, your fantasies never come true. You never meet the boy of your dreams. You never meet the great master, the teacher, who satisfies every criteria of what a Buddhist meditation master enlightened being should actually be. You will never find the perfect committee to join or the perfect president to serve under. You can't find a perfect wife or a perfect dog even. So, we fantasize about it. And there this wanting arises and becomes established. It's called the noble truth of the origin of suffering. No peace. Always doing something. So, dependent origination. This is part of the fabric of the Buddha's teachings. This is like seeing things from cause and effect. Remember, this is the cause of suffering. Why is there suffering? What's the reason? We see a cause and effect, and this is very, very common in the teachings of the Buddha. On seeing a sight, you want it if it's pleasing. You try to get rid of it if it's unpleasing. You abide with mindfulness and wisdom of the body unestablished, with a limited mind. And you do not understand that it actually is the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom where these corrupt, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Engaged as you are in favoring what you like, opposing what you don't like, whatever experience you have, whether pleasant or painful or neutral, you delight in that experience, welcome it, and remain holding on to it. As you do so, delight arises in you. Now, delight in the experience is a fuel. This is actually the petrol which drives the car. It is the oil which keeps the wick alight. With fuel as a condition, states of existence develop. You create the world. With states of existence as a condition, you get reborn into that world. With rebirth as a condition, here we go again. Old age, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, negativity and distress come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. all coming from just wanting, seeing a sight or any other of the five senses or six senses, you want it, you try to get rid of it. That wanting creates the world. And you get reborn into it. It's amazing, just I've been born long enough to live long enough in this world. It's only 65 years, but you've seen how much this world has changed too. Why does it change so much? Just the wanting, the craving. It's amazing just how all these little ants called human beings, because of wanting, have created this amazing mess called civilization. It's so simple when I was young. And why did we blow it all? Because we wanted it to be better. Now, maybe I'll just finish off with these two. This is present karma results and future karma results. With the five senses as the cause, the five senses as the source, the five senses as the basis, the culprit being simply the five senses, seeing beautiful sights, hearing beautiful stuff, the five sense pleasures. Presidents quarrel with prime ministers, politicians with each other, priests with imams, businessmen with households, parents quarrel with each other and with children, sibling with sibling and friend with friend. And here and there quarrels, brawls or disputes, they attack each other with abuse, fists or lawsuits, whereby they incur death, injury or loss. Now this too is a danger in the case of the five senses, the massive suffering in this life. This cause being simply the five senses. Once you have the five senses, as I said before, if you see something, hear something, smell, taste, touch something, if you want it, it's pleasing. If you try and get rid of it, if it's unpleasing. And from that, we get all the problems of our world. So said the Buddha. Again, with the five senses of the cause, people steal, commit fraud, sleep with other people's partners, abuse children, and when they are caught, they're imprisoned and ruined. Now this too is a danger in the case of the five senses, a mass of suffering in this very life, the cause being simply the five senses. And again, with the five senses as the cause, the five senses as the source, as the five senses as the basis, the culprit being simply the five senses. It's not you, it's just his senses, the fact we're born with seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and with the pleasing aspect and the unpleasing aspect, which causes us to want and to crave. People indulge in misconduct of body, speech and mind, and having done so in the dissolution of the body after death, they reappear in states of deprivation, in unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Now there is a danger in the case of the five senses, a massive suffering in the life to come. Having the five senses as its cause, the five senses as its source, the five senses as its basis, the cause being simply the five senses. You will not find a spot in the world, not in the sky, nor in the ocean, nor inside a mountain cave, where you'll be free from the consequences of any corrupt karma. Now, this is the negative part of karma, which needs to be said, but there's an important point, in this passage. I've written down the Pali for present karma results is sanditika as opposed to samparayika, which is the results of karma in a future life. And I put this down because it's so common that we chant the qualities of the Dhamma. Suvaccato Bhagavata Dhamma. Well expounded is the Dhamma of the Buddha. Sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko. This is the first word, sanditika. And you can see from this passage here the meaning of this word sanditika. It means in this very life. So this is a teaching which you can confirm, prove, experience its veracity in this very life, as opposed to something which is going to happen after you die. And so this is when you start to look at the way these words are used in other contexts, it makes it quite clear what the meaning is when we talk about the qualities of the Dhamma. And the Buddha mentioned this especially because this is not something you have to wait until you die to find out if you follow the right religion. There was Catholic rite, Jewish rite, the Orthodox, the Muslims, which one was the right religion. You have to wait until you die to find out whether you back the right horse. As far as religion is concerned, that's very, very dodgy. Because they all say that they're correct and others are wrong, but the only way you can truly find out is when you die. But here, the Buddha is saying, this Buddhism, this Dhamma, is something you can experience right now, in this very life. So you don't have to wait till you're dead to find out whether being a Buddhist was a good idea or not. I'll do it now. Well, any questions? Am I going too deep for you? Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Does this relate not only to what brings us back into incarnation, but also does it create creation itself?
Yeah, the pen origination has many levels to it. We just mentioned a tiny bit here. We're going to go into it much more deeply later on in this series of talks on the word of the Buddha. It is just a basic theme which runs right throughout Buddhism. And it starts off by saying, when there is this, then this comes into existence. And when this disappears, that disappears. Just a basic causality. And it was mostly on that premise that the Buddha put all his teachings, on a causal law, finding out not just what's happening, but why, where it comes from. And when the cause vanishes, then so does the effect vanish. So that goes for everything. Specifically, our dependent origination was answering the question which I'm often asked, how can you have rebirth, reincarnation, without a soul? And that, so many people keep asking that question. When Buddhism teaches anatta, but you also teach reincarnation, isn't there a conflict there? How can you have reincarnation with nothing to be reincarnated? And it's just exactly, it's a process of cause and effect. A cause, then you have the effect becomes the cause of the second effect, the second effect becomes the cause of the third effect. It's like a rolling snowball. One thing causing another, with nothing which is essential in the beginning, which carries on all the way through. It's a processed P, without a P to being processed. So I used to like processed P's when I was a kid. Yes.
So is creation caused by beings wanting to exist and one thing
exactly,
leading to
yeah.
another?
Yes, but many beings, we yes. create. The mind is a forerunner of all things. But don't call creation as one event, which is a really weird way of looking at it. Creation is a continual event, a continual process rather, not just one event that God created the universe and we're stuck with it. No, we are continually creating. Yes. Okay, here we go. Who's going to get there first?
Ajahn Brahm.
Yeah.
No doubt, what is mentioned in the sutta is true, very true. Okay.
You sure?
But we all have to also bear in mind, you know, the stages towards enlightenment. You know, it might take many lifetimes too. You know,
right? Yeah, of course.
So you know, from this sutta, okay, it's very extreme. You know, unless you are a highly evolved person, then you can do this, isn't it? But for a newcomer, you know, okay,
yeah.
they must be, don't you think? They have to be true to themselves too. You know?
But remember, true to their non-selves.
Sorry?
Not true to themselves,
yeah,
Eddie,
but then,
to be true to their non-selves.
Yeah, true to their non-selves, but they still have us. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so if you have, like, if you have too much pleasure, that's suffering. Not having that to them is suffering too.
Ah.
So you have to be true to yourself, or I'm at stage 1 or stage 2, you can jump to stage 10.
But what happens, Eddie, is there's something even I would resist these sayings and these teachings at first, and I think, no, that's too hard for me, too much for me. But unfortunately, there's something in these teachings which you know are true.
No doubt it's
and,
true.
And they're going to get into you, and you can't get them out once they're inside, and they will change you. Unfortunately, that's the way these things work. Whether you like it or not, no matter how much you resist it, it's too late for you, Eddie. Sorry. You shouldn't have come into this class to begin with.
I do understand this. I follow it very much, I tell you.
Yeah.
Because I'm not young. But I'm talking about a newcomer.
Oh, the newcomers don't come.
And you're telling them no sex, nothing, this thing. You go cuckoo.
I know they don't go cuckoo. I never went cuckoo. Maybe I did I? Now, don't worry about, because this is a class which is, this is something which was a difficult thing for me to make a decision on. Should I teach lay people as I teach monks? It was a question asked on Friday night. Or should I hold things back? And I thought that it doesn't make sense. It's not fair. It's discriminatory. Because, yes, many people may not understand this, many people may turn away from this, but there's enough people. There are plenty with little dust in their eyes. Let's teach, as I teach monks, let's just go for broke. This is what the Buddha said, let's put it in there. And it's interesting you're saying this, because when we do these teachings before, the way they are translated, they don't have punch. And I found out when, by doing a really accurate translation with hardly any repetition, the punchiness of these teachings of the Buddha is far more, they're far heavier. They're wow. And you don't get distracted just by repetitions and by stuff you don't understand. So it's heavy stuff, I agree with that, but I think it's worthwhile.
This is a wonderful sutta.
Oh yeah, the whole lot. This is the whole Buddha. Anyway, here we go. Where did I get to? Calm as volition. Oh, what, did you get to that one? Oh, God, lost me. Oh, that's right. Present calm results, future calm. You're not finding a supporting card. Calm as volition. We've got a few more minutes. Let's go here. I'll just finish off with the karma of as volition. Volition, will, is karma, said the Buddha. Powerful statement. When you will, when you want, you do something, that is karma. For I say, having willed, you act by body, by speech, or by mind, one of those three. So that is why when people sort of, you may sort of do a terrible deed, you're driving down the road and you hit a little kid and kill it. And sometimes people feel so remorseful, but you did not will that. That was not your intention, not your volition. It is karmically ineffective. And it's important that we make that very clear to people, because there's much things in your life, you cause problems, but that was not your intention, you didn't mean to do that. Literally, that it wasn't your will, therefore it's not karmically active at all. And because we live in a very much a blame society, and we blame far too much guilt and too much suffering in this world. But if you will it, then you have to take responsibility for it. Having willed, you act by body, speech, or mind. And what is the diversity of the karma? There is karma to be experienced in a hell realm. Yes, there are hell realms. You make them. There's something which I saw a long time ago, and Ajahn Brahmadi, good on him, he looked at the sutta in Pali much more closely than I looked at it and said, Ajahn Brahm, yes, you're right. It's not a person sends you to karma. You're not judged by some sort of terrible court somewhere and said, Eddie Koo, you are sentenced to 20 years in the hell realms. That doesn't happen. You send yourself there. No one else does. And you go as long as you think you deserve. And especially those people who have lots of guilt. Which is amazing, just how people have this guilt inside of them. They feel they need to be punished, and my goodness, they do punish themselves. And that's just so sad for someone like me who cares about people, loves you. You don't need to do that, but you have to. You just can't not do it. That's so ingrained in you. And that's what happens when people die. and things which you did, which you're not proud of, and it's your naughty things which you did. You've hurt other people. And why should you be punished? Why? But that's what we think. And so we actually create a hell realm. And we stay there as long as we think we need to. The interesting, I'm just going off on an anecdote here. The incident which really made it very clear to me was actually when I was overseas teaching in Indonesia, and had a good friend over in Indonesia, Venerable Sri Panyawara, a very lovely monk. I tried to get him to come over here, but he hates travelling. He was the one who offered the stupas and the two lions at Jhana Grove, because, you know, he lives around Borobudur area. So when I went to visit him once and give a talk at his temple, he was so kind, a very lovely monk. And so he gave me the guided tour around Borobudur, you know, by a monk, a very senior monk. And that was just amazing, because he knew more about that than any of these guides you have to pay for. And on one of the carvings on the bottom level, which is supposed to be the hell realms, and as you go up, you get the deva realms. And on the bottom, there was this carving of one of the old Jataka stories of a guy, a man, who had done the terrible karma of pushing his mother over and injuring his mum. And because of that, you know, he was reborn, because he thought he needed to, in this hell realm with the razor wheel. And he saw this other guy being tortured with this wheel of razors cutting into his head constantly. Now, you know, this is just how people imagine, you know, pain, torture, punishment. And this guy said, I was told after, so I forget how long, 4,900 years of this punishment, another man would come who did the same thing which I did, which pushed my mother over. And then when he came, my punishment will be over. Now you've come. And at that, the razor wheel left this first person's head and came into this new guy's head. Incredible suffering. But this guy, you know, he's supposed to be punished for pushing. Then this guy suddenly thought of kindness, compassion. It's a terrible thing to do, to harm your mother. But it's also this terrible punishment. So I resolve to take the next five people's punishments. May this wheel stay in my head for 2,000 or 450 years or something. I'll take my punishment in the next five out of compassion for them. And that just thought of kindness for other people who pushed over their mother, that thought of kindness was enough to make that razor wheel explode, shatter, and he got immediately reborn in the heaven realm. And the meaning of that was that you can only exist in the realm of punishment if you have negativity. If ever you're in a sort of a down state, depressed state, hell realm, just thoughts of kindness and compassion, softness, explode those prisons. You cannot exist in such a state with a compassionate mind. You go to where you belong. And so that exploded the razor wheel and he got reborn in a heaven realm. You make those realms, they're mind made. So if you have a compassionate mind, immediately that realm vanishes and you're compassionate. Now you've had dreams, sometimes dreams are really negative, having a difficult time. If you can somehow generate a kind thought during a dream, the terrible dream disappears. These are mind-made, but far more real than in the dreams, but similar in the fact that the way your mind is, how it affects stuff. So that's actually the hell realms. They are not out there and you get reborn into them. They're not like Paris, which exists whether you go there or not. You make them and you stay there as long as you like, as long as you deserve. That's why they're mind made. You understand that, how we create this stuff. Volition is the karma. You will it and it happens. So there is the karma to experience in hell, in the animal realms, the realm afflicted, the ghost realms, the human realm, the heavenly realms. This is called the diversity of karma. And what is the result of the karma? The result of karma is, say, threefold: to be experienced in this life, in the next life, or in some subsequent life. This is called the results of karma. Okay. Almost the end of this. So we'll do the inheritance. The owners of their karma, heirs of their karma. They have karma as their origin, karma as their property, karma as their resort. Whatever karma they do, good or bad, they are its heirs. And that's why we often say that if you want to invest in anything, forget the stock market, forget gold, forget commodities, the karma stock market, because that goes with you from life to life. Wherever that karma ripens, is there you experience its results, either in this life or the next life or some subsequent life. There comes a time when the great oceans dry up and evaporate and no longer exist. Global warming, Buddha predicted it. But still I say there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming through rebirth and death, blinkered by delusion, shackled by wanting. There comes a time when the Himalaya, the king of the mountains, burns up and perishes and no longer exists. But still I say there is no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming through rebirth and death, blinkered by delusion, shackled to wanting. There comes a time when the planet Earth burns up and perishes and no longer exists. But still I say there's no making an end of suffering for those beings roaming through rebirth and death who are blinkered by delusion and shackled to wanting. That's another thing which I really was quite inspired by these teachings. Just the time scale of it is vast. Not just a few years, but this whole amazing perception of just even planet Earth burning up and perishing, no longer existing, which is going to happen. According to physics. So, any other questions before we finish off? Yes, John.
I don't think someone was in a war and enjoyed killing and really thought it was great fun, he wouldn't go to hell on the death because he didn't have any suffering, any remorse for.
If you have a look at any psychologist, post-traumatic stress, at the time they may think they're enjoying the killing, but it's amazing just how much resources military to deal with what happens when the soldier comes home. There's huge psychological damage. It's not the people who are exempt from that. Just about all sort of military personnel in conflict situations experience that post-traumatic stress. It's trauma to kill somebody, to see their eyes. It's one of the reasons why, I read a book of, it was actually only the foreword, I think, of a general who was saying that the hardest thing as a general training soldiers was to get them to actually pull that trigger. In old days, when the soldiers would face each other, you'd see the person you were shooting. There were so many soldiers refused to pull the trigger, even though they knew they were going to be killed. And that was the hardest thing, as a general, to get the soldiers to actually pull the trigger. You know the way they solve that problem now. They shoot the trigger thousands of miles away, from a drone, automatic. So they're not really seeing the eyes, they're not really smelling death. They remove one soldier from his victim as far as possible, physically, emotionally. That's the only way you can get people to kill. Face to face, it's just so difficult for one person to kill another. If you were drafted to war, if you actually drafted, you had no choice, and you put a gun in your hand, and somebody was coming up to kill you, John, you probably wouldn't be able to pull that trigger. Self-defense, yeah, you're going to die, but you just can't do it. It's amazing, just to kill is just an incredibly difficult thing for many people to do. And if you do it, you can see just how many people in the veterans' hospitals, on drugs, alcoholics, because they have done it, they have killed. and the scars of her life. It's not an easy thing to do. So there is, yes, deep karma there.
I've seen people like were in Vietnam War or some other war, and like they were actually like just before they're dying, they're actually more agitated and needed more and more like relaxing
morphine.
Morphine and like other drugs that actually reduces the stresses and anxieties. Like 3, 4, 5 times more than the usual. I mean, it could vary between person to person, but actually it was quite significant amount they needed to reduce their agitation. I don't know if it happens to everyone, but I did see.
Yeah, I think John was thinking, could there be an exception? And I don't think, I've never seen an exception.
Sorry?
I've never seen an exception. Someone who has not got remorse. That's again one thing which hit me when I used to go into prisons. And going into prisons at first, the prisoners which I met, some were murderers and rapists. At first they would show no remorse. But then later on you got to see them and talk to them and they had huge amounts of remorse. They wish they'd never done that, really deep down. And I'm talking them to about the other people in prison who done these terrible, terrible acts. And they also said, we've never met anybody in jail who was at peace with what they've done. They were all suffering, not just from being in jail, but from the remorse, the guilt of their actions. So I don't think there is a person who just enjoys killing. Maybe they may at the moment, but they have incredible remorse afterwards. Anyway, there was, first of all, yes. One moment, because she had her hand up first. Yes, over Sue. Sue.
Ajahn, you were talking about the cycles of the universe.
Oh, yeah.
So that goes in, say, our realm would go in from the creation as we know it into jhana realms.
Yeah.
And then back out into what we know.
Yes, it was this world, yeah.
And so would there be beings that can actually continue to cause rebirth throughout the changes of the universe and go just on forever?
Well, not on forever, for a long, long time. Because when it comes to the Buddha, he said, I forget what the number was, but it was an unexpected number, I think 91 cycles of the universe he could remember.
Right.
And you know, it wasn't sort of like 100 or some nice number like 99 or 88, which is a lucky number in Chinese. Mm. It was like 91 or something.
That eons. He could remember.
Basically cycles of universes. So that's a pretty good memory.
So actually some beings, the only thing that's going to get us out of this is to become enlightened. Otherwise,
exactly, yes, otherwise you keep coming back again and again and again. And just, big bangs or big crunches or whimpers or whatever. Universes do end, they have to end. But then another one comes up afterwards. And here we go again. Even universes get reincarnated. And that's actually basic science. Okay, yeah, you had one last question, then we finish off.
It's
it gone now?
Passed.
Yeah, oh, passed, okay. Okay, well, I think it's an hour and a half, so I think that's enough for today. So we just got to the noble truth of the cause of suffering. And now we get next time being the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Now this is much better for Eddie's beginners because it's much more positive. End of suffering. But anyway, here we go. So let's pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha now. Arahang Samma Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Chanting.